This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and we're going to begin our program today with a conversation with Hammond Mayor Tom McDermott Jr. He's joined us in the studio here at Lakeshore Public Radio. And Mayor Tom, thank you for joining us for today. It's nice to have you here to talk with you and get caught up on some things. A lot to talk about. A lot of it has to do with improvements that will come over time to the city of Hammond in particular, and hopefully to the region as well, too. But a lot of it has had to deal with making a lot of trips to Indianapolis. You have found yourself spending, I'm sure, more time than you usually do as mayor of Hammond down with the General Assembly, because this particular session has been a very important one for the city of Hammond. Bring us up to date on probably the most major project I know that directly affects the city of Hammond is the proposal that's gone through the legislature to get some tax incentives set it up to be able to get the data center created. Tell us about that.
Sure. Well, it's a bill that, you know, the state of Indiana, Indiana Economic Development Corp and the city of Hammond worked together to help land this project. It's at the former state line generating plant, which used to be $100 million on the tax rolls of assessed value and hundreds of jobs. When that went away, it took us a long time to try to figure out what could possibly take its place. Mm-hmm. It's a very high-profile location. When you're driving to Chicago on the Skyway, you can see it off to your right. So, the data center, we ended up meeting these gentlemen, a gentleman from the region that lives in Carmel now. He's an attorney that represents data centers named Tom Dockich. We ended up meeting him. And through our failed Amazon bid, funny enough, so we were audacious enough in Hammond to put in for HQ2 to be located in Hammond. It didn't happen, but we met these gentlemen from Carmel that were trying unsuccessfully to locate a data center in Chicago, and then Tom Dockich got them to think differently. A guy named Peter Feldman from New York that does this on a regular basis, never heard of Northwest Indiana, and then when he realized what we offered, particularly in Hammond, which is close access to where they were looking anyway. They wanted to be on Cermak. They're just 15, 20 miles away.
Wow.
And we got lower tax environment. We got great access to water, great access to electricity, great access to the internet. So literally the Midwest power grid and the information superhighway both pass through this location. So it's a great project. It's estimated to be $40 million at the beginning, $40 million of assessed value. It's going to be closer to anywhere from $100 to $200 when it's mature. We're very excited about that. Yeah. But what's going through the General Assembly right now is a bill that will give the data centers, not just ours, any data center that wants to locate in Indiana, a break on the equipment they purchase and a break on the power they consume. And if we don't make Indiana competitive with regards to electricity and the power they consume, giving them a break on that and giving them a break on the equipment they buy, then they won't locate in Indiana.
Did it seem like it would be a tough sell to the legislature to get them to go along with this idea? Or do you think that because the Hammond Data Center project was so strong and had so much support behind it that they felt that if the bill goes through, then any data, as you say, any data center in the state of Indiana will be able to take advantage of this, and it'll just make it so much easier for any future company to come in.
These are, you know, this is the data center that's going to be in Hammond. Let's round numbers out and say it's worth $100 million.
Yeah.
It's 1/3 of the footprint of the state line generator. It's about approximately the same assessed value. It doesn't have as many jobs, but it doesn't create the pollution that state line generator created either. And we still have 2/3 of the footprint left to develop. So we could do $300-400 million worth of assessed value at this location, which is 4 times what the state line generator was, and it's clean. And we're a great option for data centers that want to be close to Chicago, but they don't want to pay the Chicago prices or the Chicago taxes.
So they've got the advantage, actually, you could have several more data centers on the same spot.
I hope so.
I guess because you've got that opportunity, you've got the first one established, mm-hmm. and you'll have more that can come in the future. And it's all because of the legislature. If they approve the bill, it's going to make it that much easier to see.
Well, you know, and really, like I was saying earlier, Hammond was audacious enough to put in for HQ2. Mm-hmm. We didn't think we were going to get it. But I didn't want to be the only mayor in America that didn't put in for it either. So
yeah,
we put in for it.
Well, we know that even Mayor Freeman Wilson did her bid as well too. And I suppose in a way it's probably showing at least to somebody out there that the city, in that particular case, the city of Gary was mm-hmm. was brought was brash enough to try for something.
That's
and
right.
they picked up their Amazon, I guess, with their warehouse that they've got in there.
Worked out well for both.
It's all probably, I guess, the way that you start being able to plan for expansion in Northwest Indiana. It may not be big jumps, but these little steps seem to all pay off.
Well, the good thing about us over here in Indiana is we have a lower tax rate and we have the access to Chicago that, you know, you can't replicate. So I'm bullish on Hammond's future. I'm bullish on the region. I think that we're going in the right direction. And I think we got great leadership all across the board. So
now the other thing I want to check on is, I mean, you keep close eye on this too, because it's so close. We're talking about the plans that the city of Gary have to be able to bring Majestic Star Casino off the boat, literally, and onto land. And then, of course, the second casino license will go someplace else. How do things, as far as you know, with the legislature stand on that? Because you're keeping a close eye, because it's going to have a big impact, and the hopes are it won't be a great bad impact, that maybe something good will come out of all of that.
I'm not really optimistic something good's going to come out of.
Yeah.
I mean, it really depends on from your perspective. If it's Gary, yeah, I think Gary's positive that this is going to be an improvement for them. But really what's happening is they're shifting. It's if the Chicago gaming market was a pie and the slices were cut as they're cut, Hammond would have a big piece. I acknowledge that. But we're also the closest to our market, which is Chicago. Okay. Chicago has the second biggest piece, and they're also the second closest to Chicago. Gary, even though they have two licenses, has two smaller pieces, smaller than East Chicago's piece, smaller than Hammond's piece, okay? And then you got Michigan City, and that's the pie. Now, the question is, if we allow Gary's casino to relocate to 8094, which is what they want to do, is that going to make the pie bigger, or are we just going to cut the pieces differently? And it's my contention, the pie is not going to get bigger. All they're doing is cutting the pie differently, which is East Chicago is going to give up a lot of their piece. East Chicago is projected to lose anywhere from 30% to 50% of their gaming revenue if this happens, and Hammond's projected to lose about 10%. So it's really not a huge impact on the city of Hammond, but on East Chicago, it's devastating.
Yeah.
So if you're looking from East Chicago's perspective, this is the worst thing that could possibly happen to them. If you're looking at it from Gary's perspective, they think this is great. I don't think it's fair, personally, and East Chicago in particular, Ameristar Casino just invested $25-30 million under the current Indiana law, which says build on your footprint.
That's right.
And they did, and you're gambling on the footprint right now in East Chicago. And now Gary, you know, instead of building on the footprint like the law says, they want to change the rules, and I don't think it's fair.
So it was just a matter of waiting to find out, I guess, what the General Assembly will do on this. Is this mainly because it's tied so closely to this gaming omnibus bill that is going to be, I guess, the key as to whether all of these things, of course, with the Buffington Harbor issue is aside, because there's a separate measure, and a lot of that has already gotten further along in the General Assembly, I understand.
Well, you know, Gary for a long time has wanted to relocate their casinos. Now, they've approached it differently this year and said, we have this opportunity at Buffington Harbor to create a deep water port in an intermodal facility. That's why we want to relocate the gaming boat. You know, I don't really see it much different than any other argument. And quite frankly, there's been no study on how much a deep water port would cost. Mm-hmm. I mean, just knowing what I know about the Hammond Marina, when we do our break wall, and it's just for a little sailboat marina, okay? When we do our break wall, it's like $35 million. So if we're going to do a deep water port at Buffington Harbor, how much is that going to cost? $100 million? $150 million? Who's paying that? Is it Gary? Is it the RDA? Is State of Indiana paying for it? These are questions nobody's talking about. But what they're very willing to do is possibly detrimentally harm the gaming industry by moving the casino license, which is contrary to state law, and they don't really know what they're going to do with Buffington Harbor after that. They talk about a lot of things, but, you know, I've talked about a lot of things as mayor, and then one thing I realize is you can't really talk unless you have the money to back it up and get it done. Nobody's talking about how much that's going to cost, and it's not going to be cheap.
And we'll just have to wait to see. That's another of the pieces in the pie, I guess, that the General Assembly's mulling over right now, trying to make a decision on. And I guess the only hope is that you find out something soon.
And you know, that doesn't even talk about the big gorilla in the room is Chicago and what they're going to do with in Illinois, what they're going to do with the gaming industry. They're going to build a casino closer to Hammond, and if they do, we're going to be fighting against Illinois and against Chicago. And at the same time, You know, I'm sitting there looking over my shoulder in Indiana, and I got the state coming at us, too. It's, you know, we're feeling a little lonely in East Chicago and in Hammond right now.
We're talking with Hammond Mayor Tom McDermott Jr. about the issues that the city faces, and good news and bad news as well. We've heard about the good news with the plans for a measure that is moving through the General Assembly that will offer tax incentives for, to start out, to certainly, the data center that is proposed to go along the lakefront in Hammond, and then maybe even more data centers in the future to come. One of the things I wanted to have a chance to talk with in particular about is, I guess, there's been discussion of trying to find a way to be able to come up with the convention center that everybody seems to want to have established because of the closing and now demolition of the facility here in Merrillville. Over the time, the White Lodging is going to be doing some big things in their own property, on where the, of course, where the facility used to be located. But the idea is that you have to plan for the future, and the discussion is now branching out to other places. Other areas I know that in particular that had been discussed for potential sites for convention centers was in Hammond, and it still is kind of in the works, too, I guess. Tell us where things kind of stand now. You've had discussions off to the side here from everything about a convention center.
Well, I think the best location for a convention center in Lake County is not Hammond, actually. I think it's a site in Highland. And, you know, I know Bernie Zeman, the councilman in Highland, and I had talked about this location, and, you know, and Spiros, the head of the South Shore Convention and Visitors Bureau, and I have had this discussion, and I know Spiros has talked with Bernie and town officials in Highland about it. The reason I think it's such a great location, it's where the Highland Public Works Complex is, right off of Kennedy. It's across from my brand new development in Hammond, Oxbow Landing. So we could literally throw a bridge over the Little Calumet River and connect the two pieces of property. It's right off the highway. And Highland owns all the property. And it's a humongous piece of property because it's the town works, public works complex. Plus, they have all the softball fields and all that. I mean, you could put $100 million... state-of-the-art convention center right there. It's across, it's catty corner to the current South Shore Visitors Bureau. I think it would generate tremendous, you know, economic development around it. It would be in Highland. And the question is, how do you pay for it? And we're working on that right now. It would take action from the General Assembly to allow it. And it would be a fairer plan than the plan that was being proposed to you know, the food and beverage tax across the entire county. There was a lot of people, myself included, that didn't think that was fair, that you'd be in Miller Beach and Gary, which is nowhere near 65 and 30. And when you buy a hamburger in Miller Beach and Gary, you're paying 1.5% towards a development in Merrillville. That's where it starts getting sticky. So I think that if we're going to have any type of tax that, you know, where you could use the increment to help create the convention center, it's got to be very focused, you know, where the economic impact will occur. So,
do you think that this is the possibility of a project that maybe might not get really underway in 2019, but at least the groundwork is being laid in 2019 and maybe 2020 before something actually happens?
It wouldn't, under the current plan that's being discussed, which is very conceptual, and it's just South Shore Convention's involved, Town of Highland's involved, and so is the City of Hammond. There is no way we could get it done in 2019 because it would take action by the General Assembly to allow it. So if this occurred, we would go next year before the General Assembly and present our proposal. If it was approved, then theoretically, you know, we might be able to begin construction in 21 on the project. And I don't think it's a stretch to think it could happen. I really don't. But it would take some type of – it would be interesting. It would be like regional type of government between Hammond and Highland that made that happen. You know,
I know that there's some other locations that have been proposed by consultant, and they are some of them, of course, elsewhere. But that was seemed to be one of the key spots that they talked about. There was the opportunity to use the land that is located kind of it's in between. I say it's Highland, it's a little bit of Hammond. It's also an opportunity to use all the traffic that comes on 80-94 to feed into the convention center. Easy access from I-65.
You'd be able to see it from 80-94. Where we're talking about, and it is all Highland. It's because it's across the river, but it's literally the border, the northern border of Highland. And you know, they could do it tomorrow if we had the financing mechanism, and that's what's holding us up. Because we're talking about a big project. This is over $100 million, I'm sure.
Well, it's going to be interesting to see what does come out here in 2019 going into the new year and see if the General Assembly is agreeable to be able to make the rule changes so that you get this.
I think it's cool, too, that, you know, there's Highland and the South Shore Convention and Visitors Bureau and the City of Hammond are talking about a regional project and talking about working together. That's something that I think a lot of people should take to heart, that, you know, a lot of people have this viewpoint of their government that, you know, we're all in our silos and we don't cooperate, and that's just not true. And this is a perfect example of it. If this happened, it would only be because we partner together.
Let's talk about the situation that all governments here, and certainly in Northwest Indiana and some other areas in particular, because we're the last of the bunch to face is the end of the property tax caps and the impact it's going to have on local governments in particular. And I know that you have already expressed to your friends and fellow business people and colleagues in Hammond about the concerns that you have to the city of Hammond's budget, and you're trying to, make the way for having to make some changes. You mentioned, I think, and even in fact, one recent story said that it's going to be a tough year. 2020 is going to be a very difficult budget year. Tell us what the city of Hammond is going to face when the property tax caps are finally released for the region.
Well, we have, you know, the good news in Hammond is we have more revenue than expenses. So, and we've become accustomed in Hammond, because we have so much revenue coming from the casino boats and from the sale of water to Illinois, we've become accustomed to spending $15, $16 million a year on just the infrastructure, on park projects, on sidewalks, on street projects. And what I've been preparing my council for and preparing my staff, you know, for is it's not going to be like that anymore. I mean, it's theoretical to think we could lose $5, $6 million of spending next year, which is, you know, but we're starting to get to the point where it's concerning, because, you know, you don't want to lose that kind of revenue, and there's really no makeup mechanism for it. You know, that's the frustrating thing about being a mayor in Indiana is there's not a lot of tools out there that allow you to create revenue.
Now you can make some adjustments, I suppose, with economic development tools that you have, but you can't go beyond that by adding new taxes.
You have TIF, but TIF doesn't help your budget. TIF helps build things, right? Like if I needed to bring a business in and they needed incentives, I could, you know, go to a TIF district and help create economic development. But that doesn't help you if you're finding ways to pay for 210 police officers that are very expensive. Each police officer costs the city around 100,000, probably a little bit more, and I have 210 of them.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's a $25, $26 million budget right there we're talking about. And then the fire department's a $15 million budget, and that's not my only employees. You know, I have people that need to pick up the garbage. I have people that mow the parks. I have people that fill the potholes. I have people that, you know, maintain the water. I mean, it's very expensive, and the state of Indiana is very good at taking money away, but they're not really good about giving it back. And last I checked, is people want to pay lower taxes. I get that, myself included. I'm a taxpayer. But at the same time, they don't want to see the number of police officers change. They don't want to see your firemen get laid off. But they don't realize that, you know, this money goes to pay for all these people. And if it goes away, then there's very few answers left.
Are you finding that you're spending a lot of your time as mayor in talking with citizens and other people, as well as with your own employees, your own staff members and all, trying to get ready for this if they haven't already gotten ready?
Well, we've been talking about this because if you remember correctly, when taxpayers in Indiana voted for the tax caps, that was 10 years ago, and they gave Lake County and St. Joseph County a 10-year waiting period, basically, to get ready for this date that's coming next year. So we've been getting ready. In Hammond, you know, over the years, we've, you know, eliminated the health department. We've eliminated weights and measures. We eliminated, you know, we privatized recycling. You know, I shut down recently the city court.
So, yeah, there's a lot of things that you can tell that's been in the news and have you brought up here publicly about being ready to make the changes so that come 2020, it won't be as much of a shock as I'm sure it will be.
Right, but it's still going to be a shock, and then we'll adjust, you know. The scary thing is the first year, because you don't know what's coming.
Yeah.
And then once it comes, I remember we went through this when we changed the way we tax our properties, and we went through an adjustment period, and then we got used to it, and it's always the first year you're worried about. I remember at one time we were all scared of the year 2000. We thought the world was going to come to an end and all our computers were going to shut down. And then it happened and we were like, okay, I have a feeling that's how it's going to be when we get our new tax
maybe
bills.
So maybe it won't be quite as dramatic as the change to the 2000s, to be sure. We know that you are going into another election here, running for re-election.
I'm bored. I got nothing.
Well, I was going to say it's just very quiet right now for the primary election. That may, of course, change in the general election as it comes up towards November. But because that you have the advantage of being a key leader in the Indiana Democratic Party, I've been asked, and I thought about this too, just ask for your assessment of how you think that the Indiana Democratic Party is doing with all the changes that we've gone through. And in particular, and I know the political analysts have talked about this as well too, with the fact that that we no longer have a Democrat as a U.S. Senator.
Yeah.
What's the party prognosis going to be like going into this election coming up, as well as the years ahead?
You know, it's, in my opinion, one of the problems we have in the party is Hoosier Democrats is we don't have that statewide elected official. And even when we had Joe Donnelly, who was an amazing senator, and quite frankly, I think he should have been reelected. He wasn't, but I think he was amazing. I think he did his job for 6 years and deserved to be reelected personally. But nonetheless, when we did have Joe Donnelly, he wasn't really – he was involved in D.C., which is where senators are supposed to be involved. So we didn't really even – if we have had the governor's office, if John Gregg and Christina Hale had won in 2016, we wouldn't be asking ourselves – these questions right now, because John would be the leader of the party, and you know, he, the governor, would, in that case, he would sort of dictate what the policies we follow are. But our problem now is we don't have that person, and our policies are, it really depends on what part of the state you're in. In my opinion, I think the policies that we push as a party are too liberal for Indiana, and it drives away voters, and that's not my politics. I've always been successful because I get people from both parties to vote for me, mostly Democrats, don't get me wrong, but I have a lot of Republicans that support me, and they trust me, and they like what I'm doing in Hammond, and if I ever ran in Indiana, I think I can get Republicans to vote for me, but I would be out of step with my own party in a lot of cases because my party's really, really swung far to the left, and it makes me uncomfortable. I don't think that's a successful formula in Indiana.
So I guess you've of course, I'm sure, been approached by a lot of people asking if you're interested in other offices, and it's come up for discussion from time to time. Would you, although you have your hands full now as being mayor of Hammond and going into another, maybe not this election cycle, but one in the future, do you think that you, if have been approached, that you might take it up?
Yeah. Yeah, I do.
Is there?
I think it's going to happen.
Do you think you may, just what you just mentioned here about the fact that the way that you feel that you're in step in being able to work quite literally with both parties in a way you have that you have support from both parties here in at least in the region. Do you think that there is a possibility that maybe that could extend out to the rest of the state, or you could at least show that to the other communities in the state that you're a viable candidate?
I think I'd be a good candidate in Indiana. I would have to work hard because of where I'm from, and there's a stereotype about Democrats that live in Northwest Indiana, and I would have to overcome that. But I think that under the right circumstances, I'd be a very effective candidate in Indiana, and it's something I'm interested in for sure. And the voters of Hammond for my fifth term have given me a free pass right now, which is beautiful. That tells me that they're satisfied with what's going on. And we all realize we don't live in utopia, but we're heading in the right direction. And I got a great team. And, you know, it's an honor to be unopposed. But I'm interested in pursuing my career, and I think I would be successful.
So you say never say never, I guess, if you're approached to
that. But I have the best, in my opinion, I have one of the best jobs in Indiana right now. And that's tough because I've been approached a couple times for jobs. And then I think about it, and then I compare it to the job I have currently, and I usually say, it's hard to beat this job I have. You know, my bosses are nice to me, the residents of Hammond.
Right.
I get along well with my other boss, the city council. We're moving in the right direction. And, you know, so that's the thing. It's really hard to give up something you're really happy doing. And I'm really happy being the mayor. It's the best job I've ever had. That's why I've been doing it for 15 years.
Well, Mayor McDermott, we're glad that you're, number one, that you're mayor. Number two, that you've come to visit us here at Lakeshore Public
here.
Radio.
I appreciate it, Chris.
And being with us to talk about some of these issues and being candid about how you feel about it. And,
thank you.
And to be able to let people know that there are concerns out there, that the state of Indiana is making its way through the changes that we are all facing, and we can look to the future. Just if we do things right and plan things right, we'll do well, I suppose.
Thanks, Chris. It's good to see you.
It's good to see you, and thank you for being with us today. On this edition of the Times Byline podcast, hosts Cale Wilk and Carly Lenich will take a look at the initiative by the North Township Trustees Office that is seeking to improve the livelihood and education of teenagers and students. Here's the podcast.
So basically, like you said, this will be the position of the show. Each person will have a mic, and what we'll do is, for those who are on the end, that'll be Anna.
Yes.
What you're hearing is a youth steering committee at the North Township Trustees Office in Hammond.
they've been meeting and preparing for a big day this month, a youth summit occurring today at Purdue University Northwest in Hammond. That's bringing together multiple high schools to discuss issues pertinent to not only adults, but teens. They include suicide prevention, abuse, violence, drug use, mental health, coping mechanisms, and more.
Yeah, she is here. I'll talk about 13 Reasons Why Not, our event that we had, because it'd be really fresh the next day. So what happened during the event, a little take back from the event, and what we plan to do with the initiative. Then it will go to you all to introduce yourself. So
the summit is titled 13 Reasons Why Not. The name is a play off of the Netflix series 13 Reasons Why. The show is based on a book with the same title and features a story in which a teen high school student takes her life, but leaves cassette tapes explaining her grievances that led up to her suicide. The show has proven controversial and has taken some flack, mainly that a lot of critics have felt it glorifies suicide and takes an inappropriate approach to such a serious topic. The North Township Trustee's Office is offering an approach to get the ball rolling in a way for students in their jurisdiction to have a forum to voice their concerns. So let's jump back into that with two main leaders helping to shepherd these students in the committee, Rosie Quintanilla and Tavel Grant, a couple of community development coordinators in the office.
I got my degree in social work, and I throughout my whole career, education, I always thought, you know, oh, I'm going to be taking kids out of homes. And that was kind of the stigma placed on social work. And I think I get to work with teens in a different light, and I get to actually hear what they have to say. The issues are the same, but it's different identifying markers or factors that are in place that we never grew up learning about. And I think it's so important that I've gotten to learn from these students. They're not learning from what I am. I'm learning from what they're going through.
Currently, I'm a youth pastor, so I really do enjoy working with young people, specifically teens. But for me, it's more personal because a lot of what we're giving to them wasn't given to me. Yeah. And some of what I had to learn was just, you know, by trial and error, is by experience. And so me having the opportunity to pour into young people to help them and to see, okay, we both have some of the same struggles. We both have some of the same things that we have dealt with. And here's what you can do. Here's the prevention. Here's the coping mechanisms. It just makes it a beautiful thing for me. It makes me, to, you know, happy to live and to wake up in the morning that I can help somebody in an area that I knew I needed help in as well when I was their age.
The 13 Reasons Why Not Summit comes just a couple years after the Trustee's Office launched its No More Secrets campaign, bringing light to issues of child sex abuse in Indiana. This week's summit is the office's most recent attempt to not only educate the public, but to spur students and community leaders to advocate for change.
And I think one thing that I've noticed from all of the students in our steering committee is that they all know right from wrong. They all know that you're not supposed to do this. They all know that you're supposed to go look for help, or that you're supposed to speak up when you see a friend that's struggling with something. But I think one of the biggest, I guess, blockers for them is knowing where to go, knowing who to talk to.
The office is seeking to address 13 topics, which include nutrition and mental health, autism awareness, bullying, suicide prevention, violence in schools, anxiety and depression, substance abuse, teen dating violence, childhood trauma, hope for immigrant children, safe social networking, race and values, and self-esteem. It's some big topics to try to tackle in one day.
And it's almost like what not to do in that show. I think the show depicted sexual abuse, sending inappropriate photos, suicide. It showed that the guidance counselor wasn't able to help the student. So it shows all the issues that these students are really facing, but it's what not to do. What are the resources out there? What are the coping mechanisms that you can develop as an individual to help you overcome those struggles and not relate to substance abuse or suicide or other emotional or mental issues? When we were in high school, and probably when you guys were in high school too, there wasn't anything like this. There was never any kind of event or even a program, or even at the Catholic schools, there was never really like a retreat like this that talks about these issues. So for them to be able to be the first group to get to know this and get to experience this, I want to see what they're going to do after and how it can change their lives or how it can cause a shift in the conversation of suicide and sexual abuse and things like that. So, and we hope that the students that are at our youth summit really understand their peers' perspectives. And I think that's why we put together this youth steering committee, so that they can put their voices out there and they can see that other students are struggling with the same things that they are, that there are resources out there, that there is a way to get over the struggles that they're facing.
And it's necessary that they do, especially considering that priorities and technology have changed to create a totally different school environment than most can remember.
On the note of those teens, let's hear a bit from them.
The introduction is just simple. Your name, how old you are, you know, your grade, that kind of thing. If you want to talk about what you like to do.
There's seven that were chosen for the steering committee. They include Lilia Brunetti, a 16-year-old junior from Munster High School, Anna Celine Garcia, an 18-year-old senior from Hammond High School, Brandon Fuentes and Felicity Miranda, a 16- and 17-year-old senior and junior from Bishop Knoll Institute, Jaina McCarthy, a 16-year-old sophomore from Highland High School, Ellie Presnall, a 17-year-old junior from Andrain High School, and Julian Torres, an 18-year-old senior from East Chicago Central High School. The North Township Trustee's Office sent out an invite to school superintendents, who then siphoned it down to counselors and other faculty to help narrow down and select the students to help serve on the steering committee. There'll be some of the student voices leading the summit, in which they will participate in a panel discussion as a portion of the day's events. They also will take to the airwaves on WJOB tomorrow, and will have their own guest commentary premiered in the Times of Northwest Indiana. They've been reflecting on their experiences, and have prepared their talking points.
Prevention. So the question on the table is, you guys, is how do you know someone might be suicidal? Who wants to answer?
What they post on social media.
Okay.
Yeah, definitely think like noticing their behavioral changes and stuff like that.
Absolutely, absolutely.
I think there's always signs. Like, one of the common ones is like dissociation. So you're one way, your character, maybe they're happy, and then slowly they're personality is degrading and they're becoming more completely different from who they were beforehand.
What about you, Bernard?
The message on social media that some people like to give off and like post things about them that and caption it with a very like sad like saying or something, and those are just little signs that you can tell like that person's, you know, might not be having a bad day, or that can be something that's very serious.
So guys, how would you guys react to somebody who's posting something very dark or something that is not like their personality on social media? What is a way that you would react to that? Yes, go ahead.
First I would contact them, and then I would try to find somebody maybe who's going through the same thing as them or has like experienced that, or try to get them like to a therapist.
Well, let me change it up a bit. What would if it's somebody that you don't know? What if it's somebody that, you know, you're not really friends with them, but you know that they go to your school?
Definitely respond and at least try and engage in a conversation and ask about what's going on.
Yeah, I've actually had people on Snapchat, either I know them or I don't, but they'll post something that I think is alarming, so I'll reply and be like, oh, is everything okay? And I'll usually get a response.
But aside from knowing signs or statistics, the teens are full of opinions. And they include observations that mental health is something perhaps swept under the rug and doesn't receive the attention it deserves.
Ellie, what does mental health mean to you?
So to me, mental health is really important. And essentially, mental health is you being able to be the best version of yourself that your brain will allow you to be. Because I've had my own struggles with my mental health and depression. And it's hard to want to try and put on a mask for everyone else to see when it's not, like, working. Yeah. Like, you can be outwardly that positive, but on the inside it really isn't doing anything. So when it comes to, like, my friends or something saying, oh, I'm depressed or anything, it's really hard to see because I've gone through that, and it's something that you really don't want anyone else to have to go through. Or even if, like she mentioned, that they're putting themselves in a situation that they're really not in. It's hard to see it either way, if it's legitimate or not. And I think a lot of times mental health is brushed off by adults. Like, it's not seen as, like, legit. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of things seen around is, like, teens can't be depressed, which is the exact opposite, because it happens all the time.
Yeah, I agree.
So you think they shelter you from it because perhaps they believe that if you do know about this, you'll want to do it one day.
Yeah.
It becomes an option.
Wow. So
do you think then that parents really need to look at what's going on in your life, really pay attention to social media, really pay attention to television, and see that it's better if we find some prevention for it as opposed to just telling them about it? If I'm going to tell you about it, I need to have some coping mechanism, I need to have some strategies to actually help you with that. So my question is then, if a parent is looking to help their child with suicide, what is a strategy for that parent, for their child?
I think something that's like very real is toxic positivity, which is like those little, like, you'll get over it, you'll get through it, it's hard, I know, but like, those aren't going to help anyone. That's just kind of putting out there that what you're going through is tough, and I don't think that's going to change anything. So we need to offer validation in some sense of saying that I understand what you're going through is hard and you've been dealing with a lot of hard stuff, but this isn't what's the right option for you.
On the note of personal experiences, we spent time talking with a couple of the students about how they feel to be involved in the steering committee and to engage as leaders for the future of their peers. First up here is Julian Torres, the student from East Chicago Central.
Yes, it is. Well, when I first got involved, it was more of a thing that my counselor thought I should get involved with because she knows that I like to help people. I like to speak my mind, especially about the subjects that I know so much about. So when she first told me about it, I got really excited because it sounded perfect for me. Like, it just sounded amazing. And as I got into it, it's actually all I really hoped for, to be honest.
For Julian, an issue he is identified with is bullying. He opened up to the committee about how it changed him from both perspectives.
You know, I was bullied as a kid. I would come home crying to my dad, just trying to understand why they didn't like me. And then it just got to the point where, like, I didn't care anymore why they didn't like me. I wanted to be myself. I wanted to just be open about who I was. And so bullying was always a big part. Depression and anxiety was always a big part because through bullying for like 3 years, I developed a lot of depression and a lot of anxiety. And the only thing that really got me out of that dark place was helping people.
At the summit, he wants students to take away that they should be open to speaking with each other and that they aren't alone.
Because I chose to deal with it alone for years and just hiding it and just trying to stay below radar. And then it ends up blowing up in my face because a certain situation happened and it threw me into a real big hole. And to the point where my counselor actually noticed. Well, one thing I really wish I had was someone to guide me through the difficult time. Because, you know, I was young. I didn't know what I was doing. I just wanted to hide my emotions. And that's what a lot of teenagers do today. They just want to hide things. They don't want to hide their emotions. They don't want to let people know that they're struggling because it could be seen as a sign of weakness. But we need to understand that once you break out of that, like, just box, you get to realize that once you start talking about stuff, once you start acknowledging and, like, letting it get past you, letting it go, really, that's the part where it starts to get better. You start smiling more, you start laughing more.
The other student who shared some thoughts with us was Lilia Brunetti from Munster High School. She's on the Student Advisory Council at her school.
So I was really excited because I think that leadership in administration and trying to bring voice of the student body to them is really important. So that was sent out, and then luckily I got accepted to that. So subsequently, about 4 months later or so, we got a permission slip for this actual conference, and everyone on the council was set to go. And then I got pulled out specifically by Ms. Midas, who is in charge of student services. She's an assistant principal. And she extended to me the invitation to work on this committee. And honestly, I was so excited. I was really curious. I'm like, this is absolutely wonderful. And seeing all the benefits that it presented, I was really ecstatic. And I felt very fortunate to be presented with the opportunity to do so.
She draws from the experiences on the student council to bring forward what her student community says affects it most.
Something that really sticks out to me for Munster is actually something I wrote my little essay about. It's mental health. And in Munster, it's very stretched that you get a high GPA, good grades, very good standardized testing scores. So you have this huge realm of competition. It's kind of like Sparta Dome, but academically. So that's what Munster's environment is like. And I mean, for my grade especially, we're very competitive and everyone's trying to compare test scores, and the conversations that are started are based on what you got on this test or this test. So, I mean, battling that and then having all the extracurriculars between like your academic ones and then the sports. So, I mean, that's a lot to juggle, and a lot of people do juggle multiple extracurriculars and in all AP classes. So you have, with that, you have anxiety, you have stress. A lot of that leads to depression when you're comparing things to other people. You can get things like deficiency orientation, where you're very, you're telling yourself, oh, woe is me, like I can't do this. You have a low self-concept of yourself. So there are things like that in Munster.
Like Julian, she wants students to feel that they can speak up for what they believe in.
Because I think that's something that's been really prominent, is what happens to a depression or bullying report after you put it in. I mean, what does administration do? What steps should they take to, you know, help people? And the problem is, with a lot of students, they feel like they don't see changes. They feel like the problems are still happening, or that administration will just shrug it off, which in some cases, I mean, it can happen. And I mean, that puts the students at like such a bad place, because they try so hard to voice their opinion, and then they do so and they're either blamed for not knowing enough, or it just doesn't happen, just doesn't go through.
As students leave the summit today, here's what Rosie and Tavel hope students walk away learning.
I hope they take away reality. I really want this to be an honest time for them to share what's really going in their life. I even told them to tell their friends as well, seeing that it'd be on Facebook Live, to share it or comment. That way it's not just what, you know, those, the three or four who are on each show, the students, but as well their friends can give some comments, can share some things. We want people to call in as well. So if a student wants to call in, an adult wants to call in, so the conversation doesn't just come about what we as young people feel, but as well maybe what the adults feel. So I think the goal is really pushing that honesty, sharing what's going on. We can even give some stats, some strategies, but we really want people to hear what they have to say, hear their voices.
The Times Byline is a podcast about the newspaper's most fascinating stories and the reporters who report them. To hear more Byline podcasts, visit nwitimes.com and search for digital content. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. As soon as longtime professional photographer QT Luong heard that President Trump had signed the bill and created the Indiana Dunes National Park, he stopped the presses on the second edition of his book, Treasured Lands, A Photographic Odyssey Through America's National Parks, and he hopped on a plane to come to the region. While in Northwest Indiana, he spoke with Lakeshore Public Radio Sharon Jackson about his trip and his impression of the now Indiana Dunes National Park.
When you've heard that Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore became Indiana Dunes National Park, what was your reaction?
I was very surprised, because I'd been following the bill for years, actually, and I noticed that it died in the 115th Congress, and then I saw that it had been reintroduced in January in the 116th Congress, but those things usually they take months just to get out of committee, so I didn't expect it to pass that fast. So that was, I saw it on social media, a picture of the rangers posing with a cardboard sign saying park, and I was totally surprised.
What tipped you off that this was even going on, that there were discussions about turning Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore into Indiana Dunes National Park?
I've been following it for years, actually, because I have this record of being the first to photograph each of the 58 national parks. And then when there was the 59th national park, I followed it and I was the first to get there to photograph it. And I did the same for the 60th national park, which is Gateway Arch National Park, which just came last year. So I've been keeping track of it. That's what I do.
Why did you want to be the first to photograph the national parks?
It's just that that I had this record. I saw it was fun to do it. And here I had another circumstance which made me come here as soon as I could. I released a book for the Centennial of the National Park Service, which is called Treasured Lands. And over 2 years and 2 months, it sold out of free printing. So I was pretty eager to have a new printing out, and it would be a new edition, actually, because it would have one more national park. So I wanted it to be up to date. So the book had been at the printer for about a month. It was going to be printed. But when I heard about the new designation, I had to call my printer to literally stop the presses so that I could update the book. But in order not to delay the book, I had also to do that trip as soon as I could.
So why is it important for you to be the first?
It's a project that I've been doing for 25 years now to photograph the national parks. It makes it a bit more special if in addition, I come before others.
How is Indiana Dunes National Park compared to the other ones? Is there any differences that you've noticed or anything of note from your eye?
Yeah, it's very different, I would say, from most of the park. And I would consider it to be an exception because it's the land area is pretty small. And then I think it's maybe the fourth smallest national park or something like that. And in addition, the land is kind of broken up, right? It's mixed with a state park, with private lands, with industry, which is just at the doorstep of the park. So I think that's really quite different from the other park. So it's more like an urban park. But at the same time, the thing which is interesting is that also it has all this development. There's still a lot of natural diversity in the park. And if you remember, natural diversity is what drew me to the national park in the first place.
Do you think it deserves the recognition that it's gotten to be designated a national park?
It's difficult to say because I think indeed by the criteria of large area of land, I would say not quite. Some of the proponents' argument is that now these parks, which are even smaller, for instance, they designated Gateway Arch as a national park last year, right? And when Gateway Arch National Park came about, I was a bit worried that it was kind of setting up a precedent now that they have this area which is tiny and which is a city park. And I do have the feeling that, the national park, they used to be the most special areas in the country. Mm-hmm. And if I would say all the areas, they begin to vie for that designation, and now they are no longer the most special places, then it's going to dilute a bit the label national park, and it is a worry. And in some sense, it is possible that it would have been better for not to add a park that some people might consider underserving. On the other hand, I understand that people in this area are very passionate about this place, I'm really happy for them that they feel that the area got the recognition that they feel they deserve. Okay, so I heard that the park has actually a lot of biodiversity, so there's much more than meets the eye. So when you go around, the scenery, most of the places here do not look extremely spectacular, you know, like Yosemite or Yellowstone. And so in terms of scenery, it's not in the same league. We have to be frank about that. But on the other hand, I read that the park has maybe the fourth most plant species of any national park, which is something which is special, I suppose. Also, I mean, it's more of scientific interest than of interest to the casual visitor, but it's still there, I would say. So it reminds me a bit, you know, of some in some sense of Acadia, in the sense that it's a smaller year, but it does pack a lot of things, you know. So as we mentioned, we have the lake shore, the dunes, the wetlands, the forest. So I would say why not? That wouldn't be my choice necessarily, but I'm happy that it did get some recognition.
For Lakeshore Public Radio, I'm Sharon Jackson.
By the way, the second edition of QT Luong's book, Treasured Lands, A Photographic Odyssey Through America's National Parks, is set to come out later this year. Maybe it may come out even this summer. A bill that creates a uniform property value assessment got through the General Assembly's Senate on Tuesday, and Indiana Public Broadcasting's Samantha Horton says the bill would in turn help local governments that are struggling against retailers who want even lower property taxes.
The Indiana Farm Bureau says Boone County has spent more than $400,000 on legal costs, fighting big box store chains that appeal property taxes. Bill author Brian Buchanan says he brought his local issue to the State House, hoping to close loopholes in current law and help other communities.
And I will say no one likes paying property taxes, but when we have a property tax system, it's important that we all pay our fair share.
However, Senator Victoria Spartz says she fears the bill's language determining the tax value of a property impacts all businesses, including smaller ones.
This bill not just affects big boxes, it affects everyone, big companies, small company, moms and pop stores, anyone.
The bill passed 42-7 and now goes to the House, where Buchanan says he plans to keep improving it. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Samantha Horton.
Radon exposure is the leading cause of lung cancer among people who don't smoke. And Rebecca Teal tells us that the state Senate passed a bill this week to help keep kids safe from radon in schools.
The bill would require the Indiana State Department of Health to recommend schools test for the naturally occurring gas. Republican Senator Eric Bassler authored the bill after hearing that many schools in Indiana don't test for it.
You can't see it, you can't smell it, you can't taste it. So the only way to know whether it exists or not in a room or in a building or what have you is to test for it.
When asked why the bill didn't make radon testing mandatory, Bassler said he's hesitant to impose a new state law on local schools. But he says the state could consider a stricter bill in the future. The radon in schools legislation will now be considered in the state house. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Rebecca Thiel.
That's it for Regionally Speaking for today and for this week. Our thanks to Hammond Mayor Tom McDermott Jr. for joining us, and Cale Wilk and Carly Lenick with The Times for the podcast, and Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson. And we hope you'll join us on Monday.